out of London, researcher out of Beirut, Danijel Yancek. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran criticizes a top UN rights official for sidelining a report about European countries, quote, over compliance with U.S. sanctions. Lebanon's information minister rules out resigning from his job amid a diplomatic row with Saudi Arabia over his criticism of the war on Yemen. Also ahead, French president accuses the Australian prime minister of lying to him over a scrapped submarine deal. Iran's top human rights official has slammed the UN special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Islamic Republic. Qasem Gharibabadi says Javed Rahman has ignored the suffering of Iranian patients under U.S. sanctions. Gharibabadi says Rahman has also sidelined the recent report by UN experts who criticized some European countries for, quote, over compliance with U.S. sanctions against Iran. The Iranian official believes the rapporteur's behavior has put him among violators of the Iranian people's rights instead of being a defender of human rights in Iran. Political commentator Kevin Barrett says that the UN human rights establishment puts pressure on the organization to keep it in line with Western orthodoxy.
The Western human rights establishment, which dominates the UN, and there are all sorts of pressures that are put on the UN to keep it in line with the Western orthodoxy, those people are never going to take an honest look at the suffering of the Iranian people due to these U.S. sanctions, which are utterly unjustified, which aren't even supposed to be there after Obama signed the JCPOA. The sanctions were supposed to be rolled back. And then Trump came along and virtually declared war on Iran on behalf of Israel and reimposed sanctions and made them worse. And now the Biden administration is continuing with these sanctions and even ratcheting them up. So one would think that a slightly more neutral Europe would stand up against this, and that other countries would, and that the United Nations would give Iran's complaints a fair hearing, and in particular would highlight this extreme suffering of Iranians who can't get medical supplies. In the past there have been plane crashes from lack of plane parts. There's so many areas of life in Iran where people have suffered due to these sanctions.
U.S. President says Washington will return to compliance with the 2015 Iran nuclear deal if Tehran does the same. Joe Biden made the commitment in a joint statement issued with Germany, France, and the U.K. on the margins of the G20 summit in Rome. In the statement, the three European countries welcomed Biden's undertaking to rejoin the nuclear deal and make good on Washington's obligations. Biden also said he and European leaders at the summit agreed that diplomacy was the best way forward in dealing with Iran over its nuclear program. He added the U.S. was still paying the price of bad choices made by his predecessor, including the decision to quit the nuclear deal in 2018. Biden's comments came just days after he imposed new sanctions on Iran, despite calls by Tehran for the lifting of all U.S. bans. Political commentator Eve Engler believes that Biden is continuing his predecessor's policy in keeping pressure on Iran over its nuclear program.
The Biden administration basically continuing the Trump policy, suggesting it wants to reinitiate negotiations and to restart the agreement, but really. Not willing to do what's necessary to be done, which the U.S. can do, Biden can do very easily, which is withdraw the sanctions and rejoin the agreement. So I think that's what the U.S. is sort of positioning here. I think it's partly about public opinion in Western European countries, in France, U.K., Germany. Maybe partly about public opinion in the U.S., but I don't think that not that much about U.S. opinion. But there's lots of business officials, corporate officials in some of the Western European countries that aren't would like to do business with Iran and aren't completely happy with the U.S. Sanctions regime.
Lebanon's Information Minister George Kordahi has ruled out resigning from his job amid pressure from Saudi Arabia and its allies over his criticism of the Yemen war. Kordahi has said his resignation is out of the question. He has been at the center of a dispute with Riyadh after he said Saudi-led Yemen war was futile. Lebanese minister also said Yemen's Ansarullah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. Kordahi made those comments in an interview before taking office. The interview was aired earlier this week. On Friday, Riyadh expelled Lebanon's envoy and banned all Lebanese imports. Bahrain and Kuwait followed suit. That's while the UAE withdrew its diplomats from Beirut. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has said the Saudi-led campaign against Kordahi is unjust. Today marks the third anniversary of the demise of Amal Hussein, a Yemeni girl who died of malnutrition at the age of 7. A photograph of hers with a haunted look drew the world's attention to the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. She died a week after her portrait was published.
Her name means hope in Arabic. 3 years ago, a photograph of Amal Hussein showing her skin and bones sparked shock and anger across the globe. A week later, she starved to death and became a striking symbol of the catastrophic situation in the war-torn country.
The number of malnourished cases is increasing daily compared to previous years during the brutal aggression against our country. We expect that the number of malnourished children exceeds 1 million across the country. Amal Hussein was only an example of the suffering of millions of Yemeni children. What is the fault of Amal and these children who suffer from the consequences of the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia? It is the children who pay the price, unfortunately, under the coverage of the United Nations.
Amal was one of nearly 2 million children suffering from severe malnutrition in Yemen. With 3 years having passed since her death, the situation has not got any better due to the continuing food crisis in the country and the lack of medicines for children.
We receive patients from all governorates, including very bad cases that suffer from extreme poverty and are unable to provide the most basic needs of children with their medicine or food. The organizations say they provide everything, but what they receive is very little compared to what they need. and it is difficult to get medicines for malnutrition. Some parents get forced to leave the center before the treatment ends, and as a result, a large number of children die, as what happened to the child Amal Hussein back in 2018.
The years-long Saudi rule and siege on Yemen have killed tens of thousands of civilians, including women and the children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, where more than 20 million people rely on aid. Amal has died, but the hope is still alive for millions of Yemeni children who continue to suffer from the consequences of the ongoing brutal Saudi rule. However, the international community, including the United Nations, has not taken any action to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the war-ravaged country.
Another one of our headline stories, French President Emmanuel Macron has accused Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison of lying to him over the cancellation of a submarine deal. Macron says Australia's new security pact with the U.S. affects Canberra's credibility.
Think he lied to you?
I don't think. I know.
AUKUS deal was very bad news for France, but not just for France, because I think it's very bad news for credibility and of Australia, and very bad news for the trust that great partners can have vis-à-vis Australia.
Macron made the comments on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Rome. Morrison, also attending the summit, later told a media conference that he had not lied. He said he had previously explained to Macron that conventional submarines would no longer meet Australia's needs. In September, Australia scrapped a multi-billion-dollar submarine contract with France in favor of an alternative security alliance with the U.S. and Britain. The trilateral accord could give Australia access to nuclear-powered submarines. Paris denounced the deal as a stab in the back. The G20 summit is wrapped up in Rome amid protests and criticism for lacking ambition. The leaders of the world's top 20 richest nations have pledged to take climate action and a fairer distribution of COVID vaccines, but their final communique contains no specific commitments. Max Civili reports.
A two-day meeting of the G20 leaders of the world's 20 major economies wrapped up in the Italian capital on Sunday. A final communique issued at the end of the summit contains a weak compromise commitment on climate change and COVID-19 vaccine sharing, which has drawn wide criticism from some politicians, activists, and public. Leaders have agreed that nations must take meaningful action to keep the world from warming by no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels without setting any specific criteria to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Furthermore, although the communique does include plans to end overseas investment in coal this year, no specific actions to limit domestic coal use has been set out.
The latest United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report shows that we must carry out immediate, rapid, and sizable cuts to emissions to avoid disastrous consequences. So some of us are asking why we moved our goalpost from 2 degrees to 1.5 degree. Why? Because science says so.
The G20 leaders have also agreed to establish a 15% global minimum corporate tax for the biggest multinationals in a bid to end the damaging race to the bottom on corporate taxation. However, no developing or poor nations will benefit from this ruling, as multinationals have their bases in wealthy countries and large companies will continue to generate revenue in poorer parts of the world. A long-debated web tax on digital giants such as Apple, Google, and Facebook has been scrapped.
Lately, the G20 summit seems to have lost its relevance, with leaders of several countries, including China, Russia, Japan, and Mexico, not attending the meeting. During anti-G20 rallies, protesters have slammed the summit and the statements that follow, saying that such initiatives are disconnected from reality and people's needs.
The G20 summit talks weekend was accompanied by large protests. three anti-G20 demonstrations attended by young students, left-leaning groups, climate change activists and trade unions were held in Rome between Friday and Saturday.
Il G20 è fatto da persone.
The G20 is made up of politicians who want the finance to take over politics. Politicians who want our country in the hands of Brussels, Frankfurt and the Silicon Valley.
Many fear that the G20 leaders' mild pledges on climate neutrality and coal financing could result in lost momentum ahead of an upcoming crucial COP26 climate summit in Glasgow. Max Civili, Rome.
A UN specialized agency has warned that a record high in greenhouse gas concentrations is propelling the planet Earth into uncharted territory. The head of the World Meteorological Organization has issued the warning at the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow. Pateri Talas says emissions of carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide have increased over the last year. Talas says carbon dioxide is the most important greenhouse gas contributing to global warming. He has also blamed sea level rise on greenhouse emissions, saying the rise per year has hit 4.4 millimeter. That's double the sea level rise in 20 years. Talas has called for a halt in the negative trend of climate patterns, hoping that the world can see carbon neutrality by 2050. Russia has reported a record number of new coronavirus infections since the beginning of the pandemic. Now, its authorities hope to curb the rising contagion by keeping most people off work for the next week. Marina Kortunova is in Moscow.
Russian officials reported 40,993 new infections on Sunday, exceeding the previous record of 40,251 reported early. They also added that 1,160 people died of the virus on Saturday, three fewer than the record set on Friday. Russia's COVID-19 death count has raised to 237,380, by far the largest in Europe. Meanwhile, over 8.47 million infections have been recorded in the country of 146 million.
Most enterprises and non-essential services in Russia are closed till November the 7th, but the possibility to extend the quarantine is very likely, as it has already happened before.
In Moscow, severe restrictions have begun earlier. Almost the entire service sector is on lockdown. Schools and universities' classes have been closed as well. To cope with infection, President Putin ordered a non-working period from October 30th to November the 7th, when most state agencies and private businesses are to suspend operations.
I just don't understand what's going on. We have a reliable, effective vaccine, and there are only two ways to get through this period: get sick or get vaccinated.
Despite the ever-increasing growth of infections and endless semi-restrictions, some Russians are in no hurry to get vaccinated. Others consider them to be mandatory.
My opinion is very simple. Vaccination is a responsibility act. It should not be a matter of option. It should be mandatory. It's the only way people will be able to beat COVID. As simple as that.
This was not a mandatory part of the program, and people were not forced to do it. Everything could be much better. But when we understand that conditions are being set for us, if you want to work, go get vaccinated. If you want to go to the theater, get vaccinated. If you want to eat in a restaurant, here is a QR code. Get vaccinated. This is already a cattle whip method.
About 51 million Russians, just over a third of the country's people, were fully vaccinated as of Saturday.
They may say anything they want. There are many cases of how severely vaccinated people get sick and die. Why is nobody talking about this?
Observers say one of numerous factors of cited distrust in the authorities' care can be explained by the adopted budget of the new State Duma, where in the next 2 years a reduction in health care costs by 300 billion rubles provided. It seems that plans to treat Russians with vaccines against the background of medicine optimization no longer leave illusions for people. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
That's about it for me.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Mm-hmm. the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makes the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sin.
Limelight. Leading scientists and environmentalists have called on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron to declare an immediate ceasefire in a bitter Anglo-French row over fishing rights on Saturday, 30th of October, as fears grew that the United Kingdom's arguments with its European Union neighbours could overshadow the crucial COP26 summit on climate change to be held in Glasgow. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalist Toby Helm, Fiona Harvey, Peter Walker, and Robin McKee. The piece is titled France and UK Told, End Dispute or You Wreck COP26 Summit. Stay with us for more. Leading scientists and environmentalists have called on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron to declare an immediate ceasefire in a bitter Anglo-French row over fishing rights on Saturday, 30th of October. As fears grew that the United Kingdom's arguments with its European Union neighbours could overshadow the crucial COP26 summit on climate change. On the eve of Britain hosting 120 world leaders at the meeting in Glasgow, Scotland, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, said the summit would be the world's moment of truth and could mark the beginning of the end of climate change. Speaking at a meeting of G20 leaders in Rome, Italy, he added, "The question everyone is asking is whether we seize this moment or let it slip away." But as the countdown continued, there was exasperation among green groups and scientists at the way Britain and France were at each other's throats in an argument over fishing rights, at a time when the United Kingdom is also threatening to invoke Article 16 of the Northern Ireland Protocol in a move that could trigger a new trade war with the European Union. Boris Johnson's Brexit minister, Lord Frost, threatened action against France on Saturday as he reacted furiously to comments by French Prime Minister Jean Castex, who said in a letter to European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen that the United Kingdom had to be shown that it, quote, causes more damage to leave the European Union than to stay in, unquote. Lord Frost said, "To see it expressed in this way is clearly very troubling and very problematic in the current context, when we are trying to solve many highly sensitive issues, including on the Northern Ireland Protocol. This is all the more so as the threats made by France this week to our fishing industry, to energy supplies and to future cooperation, for example through the Horizon Research Programme, unfortunately form part of a pattern that has persisted for much of this year." The British government, according to Frost, was actively considering launching dispute settlement proceedings as set out in Article 738 of the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, which could lead to the use of tariffs on French goods if arbitration failed. At the G20 summit in Rome, Italy, Boris Johnson also made his feelings known to Ursula von der Leyen, saying that French threats to hold up British exports in response to the dispute over fishing licenses were completely unjustified. Asked if he believed there had been breaches of international rules by France, Boris Johnson said, "I'm worried that there might be. I'm looking at what is going on at the moment and I think that we need to sort it out. But that is quite frankly small beer, trivial by comparison with the threat to humanity that we face." But Paris and London's heated arguments on the brink of a climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland, regarded by many as the most important gathering of world leaders ever, caused astonishment within the scientific and environmental communities. Professor Nicholas Stern, whose landmark government report in 2006 warned of the catastrophic results of delaying action on climate change, said the United Kingdom and France needed to work together to address climate change rather than argue about an issue that was comparatively trivial. "There is a history of French and British leaders joining forces on climate change despite major political differences, such as Jacques Chirac and Tony Blair, after the Iraq war. And both countries must also find a way to work with China on climate change, he said. Chris Venables, head of politics at environmental charity the Green Alliance, added, "It's quite frankly ridiculous that this row could destabilize the start of the COP26 summit. They should clear this up as soon as possible and move swiftly on to the rather more important matter of protecting the future of our planet." The Glasgow summit, which opened on Sunday, 31st of October, will determine if hopes of limiting a rise in global temperatures to under 1.5 degrees Celsius can be realized. Failure could trigger disastrous global heating, scientists have warned. An overheated world would lead to calamitous rise in sea levels, heat waves of increasing intensity, and droughts of lengthening duration that would leave tens of millions of people worldwide without homes or food. Delegates from almost 200 countries will be involved in hammering out an agreement to prevent such scenarios, though climate experts have warned that they now have very little room or very little time for maneuver. Global average temperatures have already risen by 1.1 degrees Celsius since the Industrial Revolution, and only stringent emission cuts will prevent the increase from topping 1.5 degrees Celsius. At the COP26 summit in Glasgow, developing countries are expected to clash with richer countries over the funding that the developing countries say should be given to them to help introduce the green technologies needed to replace their coal and oil-burning power stations. At the same time, various countries want to continue drilling for oil as long as possible, while Pacific Island countries, who could soon be wiped out by swiftly rising sea levels, are seeking a rapid halt to extraction of all fossil fuels. It will be the task of Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, and the COP26 President Alok Sharma to ensure an agreement among these competing groups. Shadow Business Secretary Ed Miliband, who attended the 2009 Copenhagen summit as Britain's climate minister, said that as the summit opens, we're miles away from where we need to be in terms of national plans to curb global warming. The fate of future generations depends on the fate of the next 2 weeks. Keir Starmer, meanwhile, the Labour Party leader, told the Sunday Telegraph he was very frustrated by Boris Johnson's lack of leadership on tackling climate change, accusing him of throwing the Glasgow conference targets into jeopardy. The Labour leader, Keir Starmer, said, "The Prime Minister is turning into a commentator rather than a leader in relation to COP26, lowering expectations by commentary instead of leadership on the global stage."
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, our program aims to address the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the U.S. offer of humanitarian assistance to crisis-stricken Afghanistan and what it means in the context of America's 20-year-long adventurism. And we shall discuss a major crackdown by authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir in response to recent killings of the members of minority community.
Reports suggest that the Biden administration has agreed to provide aid to Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, which is staring at a major humanitarian crisis. On the face of it, the gesture appears to be altruistic in nature, but on dissecting the issue, it becomes clear that the catastrophe itself has been manufactured by the U.S. military-industrial complex. Even before Taliban's dramatic takeover in August, the country was grappling with economic recession, drought, and the COVID crisis. And then came the freezing of assets and aid by the US and its European allies, which plunged the country into an unimaginable crisis.
In a classic case of manufacturing a crisis and then play-acting to resolve it, Americans have reportedly agreed to deliver financial aid to crisis-stricken Afghanistan, while refusing to politically recognize Taliban's caretaker government. It came after first direct talks between the two sides early October in Doha, nearly 2 months after the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops from the war-ravaged country. While the U.S. government has stopped short of officially announcing the aid after two meetings with the Taliban officials, the European Union has pledged $1.5 billion in aid to Afghanistan and to neighboring countries, without specifying how it will reach the ordinary Afghans. It comes as decisions on whether to officially recognize the Taliban government and whether to unfreeze nearly $10 billion in Afghanistan's national assets held by the U.S. Federal Reserve have been effectively put on the back burner. The U.S. government blocked the access to Afghan assets immediately after the Taliban laid siege to Kabul on August 15th. 2 days later, the European Union also suspended its long-term projects in the country, leaving millions of Afghans at the risk of major humanitarian catastrophe. Since then, International Monetary Fund, as well as the World Bank, have stopped disbursing money to the country. UN Chief Antonio Guterres has warned of make-or-break moment for Afghanistan, with the economic institutions slowly breaking down. The U.S. officials, however, remain indifferent to the crisis they helped create.
The full-blown humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan did not unfold overnight. It has been in the making since the U.S.-led coalition forces invaded the country 20 years ago. On the pretext of nation-building, the foreign powers destroyed the country, fanned the flames of war, and eventually beat a hasty and humiliating retreat. Having failed to help Afghanistan become self-reliant over the past two decades, the U.S. and its allies are now strangulating the country by freezing its assets. At the same time, it's hoodwinking the international community by making flimsy promises of humanitarian assistance.
Under the previous U.S.-backed government in Kabul, around 43% of the South Asian country's GDP came from foreign aid, according to the World Bank. But still, as the former President Ashraf Ghani himself admitted in July 2020, 90% of the country's population lives below the poverty line with less than $2 daily income. A report by the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in January 2021 noted that around 18.4 million people in Afghanistan, nearly half of the population, were in need of humanitarian assistance, six times more than 4 years ago. These horrifying statistics were published before the Taliban made sweeping advances across the country, and at a time when the US-led coalition was firmly in control. So, the question everyone is asking is, what happened to the $2.26 trillion the US claims to have spent in Afghanistan since 2001? Did it vanish into thin air? Before the Americans and European froze Afghanistan's assets in August, they had for years enabled rampant corruption, filling the coffers of those who pledged loyalty to them. This gross misappropriation of funds was even acknowledged by the top US oversight body. So, the news about US or even Europeans offering aid to the country now should be taken with a grain of salt.
Now, to have more insights, we are joined by Mr. Ryan Dawson, an author and geopolitical analyst. Mr. Dawson, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's very important.
Now, as we've seen, Americans and Europeans have pledged aid to crisis-stricken Afghanistan 2 months after hastily abandoning the country. Now, do you think this so-called assistance should be seen with a measure of skepticism?
Well, certainly prudence would show that there should be skepticism toward this aid. Now, this has been ongoing even before the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. All throughout the 80s, the United States had intervened in Afghanistan allegedly to fight the Soviets, and they had aided different factions, and there's never any result from this aid, and they used it as a bargaining chip. They used food aid, for example, which they would take away if they didn't get the political results that they wanted. And so this aid, it doesn't come without consequences. Hillary Clinton is infamous for cutting off food aid, which forced factions in Afghanistan to start selling opium again out of desperation, which led to more drug cartels and nefarious things. Of course, during the occupation of Afghanistan, and that's what it was, when they annexed it for 20 years, the U.S. was protecting poppy fields. But that revenue didn't go back to Afghanistan. That revenue went to intelligence agencies, and which was used as black budgets to finance terrorist groups like ISIS in Syria.
Now, Mr. Dawson, it was the U.S. government that initiated the talks with the Taliban last year without taking the Kabul government on board. And so why is Washington now justified in freezing $10 billion U.S. dollars of Afghan assets?
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't part of the negotiations. Of course, there's different administrations, so the Trump government sat down and had negotiations with the Taliban. The Taliban did stop attacks on U.S. targets, and the U.S. stopped attacking the Taliban. So there was peace in Afghanistan so long as people upheld the agreement. Nowhere was it said, oh, later after we leave, we're going to freeze all your assets because you're not the government we really want. We were hoping the Afghan nationals that we were supporting were going to. It shouldn't be up to the United States to decide which government is in Afghanistan or not, first of all. It's not up to an outside power. That's supposed to be up to the people of Afghanistan. And when it's not, even with their civil war, what have you, the U.S. cannot be picking winners and losers in this, which it tried to do. And for 20 years, they wasted trillions of dollars, trillions with a T. Imagine if they'd spent a fraction of that on actually helping people in Afghanistan through charities or third parties, something that's not government, but that's not what happened. But they made a deal with the Taliban, and then the administrations did change, but I don't know if the old administration would have upheld the deal either. But as it is, the Biden admin comes in, reneges on the deals they made, and says, we're going to freeze $10 billion. Why do they even control that much is another question, but they're going to freeze their assets. Now, they can do it based on power and based on the bully pulpit, but if you're asking, can they do that? Yeah, they can. they have the ability to. Should they be allowed to do that? Of course not.
Mr. Dawson, one last question. Now Afghanistan is today staring at a humanitarian crisis or catastrophe. Do you think part of the blame should be shared by the U.S. and its European allies?
They are partly to blame. They left weapons caches out for whomever. And their behavior, first of all, is an act of terrorism when you take a drone and murder a family of 10, which finally got a lot of news attention, the final drone strike that took out a family, mostly children. That is an act of terrorism, and it also creates acts of terrorism as a backlash. And the drone policy and much of the house raiding policy and the double tap policy that they kept for 20 years in Afghanistan, which mainly did kill civilians, and in my opinion is terrorism itself, it's high-tech terrorism, will beget terrorism as a response. People who didn't hate or even know about the United States before is going to hate them now. Weapons of mass destruction that we say no one else is allowed to have, but that are used, cluster bombs and napalm and MK-77 and MOABs, that the military did deploy in Afghanistan at some points, they kill indiscriminately. And they had very bad intelligence where, you know, one tribe would say, yeah, that's the bad guys over there, and it's just their own personal enemies, and the U.S. would run around, attack that one, and then, oh, oops, and then rinse and repeat. And then they had lots of green on blue attacks, too. They need to just, they don't have the intelligence that was proven, so they can't do a good job of this. They engaged in acts of terrorism, whether they meant to or not. You know, if you drone strike the wrong car and end up killing the family because you got bad intel, it doesn't matter to that family. And let's be honest, this is not just all incompetency. If it, you do that a few times in the first year, you need to sort that out. And they never did. For a generation, they murdered people over there. So that is terrorism. And of course, it's going to create terrorists. But in their minds, they won't think of themselves as terrorists. They'll think of, I'm avenging my family. Well, certainly they've had a role in the humanitarian crisis. I mean, they supported drug lords selling opium, who became the little fiefdoms in their valleys. Not the best people to be in charge. And a lot of the healing that Afghanistan may have been able to do has been impossible because they've been in perpetual war for the last 30 years, really, including the Soviet occupations and then the U.S. occupation. That cycle of violence prevents the things that may have occurred in peacetime.
Mr. Dawson, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on this issue.
Madia Benjamin, author and founder of Code Pink, warns that if the U.S. and World Bank do not release frozen Afghan funds, people in the crisis-stricken country will starve. Entrepreneur and freelance translator Noor Ahmed says $1 billion in aid cannot be a substitute for nearly $10 billion assets frozen by the U.S., demanding release of the money. Steve Hank, economist at Johns Hopkins University, points to corruption in Afghanistan fueled by foreign aid, says the country is at the brink of collapse despite billions of dollars in funding.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The situation continues to be fragile in the Indian-administered Kashmir after a fresh crackdown by the Indian security forces in early October, detaining over 700 people. It came in response to the killing of 7 civilians, 4 of them members of the minority Hindu and Sikh communities. The cold-blooded killings have sparked anger and outrage across the Himalayan region, with the majority Muslim community unequivocally condemning it. However, many believe the police action against the members of the community smacks of abuse of power.
The summer capital of the Indian-administered Kashmir, Srinagar, was rocked by 3 back-to-back killings on October 5th. The first attack targeted a well-known pharmacist from the minority Kashmiri Hindu community. The second attack resulted in the killing of a non-local Hindu street hawker. The third attack killed a Muslim civilian. Barely 2 days later, unidentified gunmen barged inside a government school on the city outskirts, killing 2 teachers, a Sikh and a Hindu. In a separate but similar incident, 2 Muslim civilians were also shot dead. The spate of killings has sent shockwaves across the Himalayan Valley and sparked fear and unease among the minority communities. However, despite leading the condemnations, members of the majority Muslim community are again under the scanner. A massive crackdown by the Indian police has resulted in the arrest of around 700 people, mostly Muslims. The families of those arrested say the authorities are looking for scapegoats to hide their inability to protect the religious minorities. The sweeping action against local Kashmiri Muslims is seen as part of the controversial policy adopted by the BJP government in New Delhi since the abrogation of region's semi-autonomy status in August 2019. Pertinently, the attacks were claimed by a little-known group allegedly affiliated with the Pakistan-based militant outfit Lashkar-e-Toiba.
Following the revocation of Kashmir's special status under the Indian Constitution on August 5, 2019, New Delhi peddled a narrative of peace and normalcy, claiming that tourism has replaced terrorism in the troubled valley. But nothing could be farther from the truth. In the past 2 years, since 2019, not only have incidents of terrorism seen an alarming surge, authorities have used stringent measures to stifle dissent, detain political activists, intimidate journalists, and prevent political activities. In the process, the majority Muslim community has borne the brunt.
On August 4, 2019, close to 6,000 Kashmiri politicians, activists, journalists, and ordinary youth were arrested, internet was suspended, and a blanket curfew was imposed. It was a precursor to measures taken the next day when the disputed region's semi-autonomy status was revoked and the state was bifurcated into 2 union territories. The region remained under a communications lockdown for more than a year, even as unrest was quietly brewing. India's far-right BJP government claimed that peace and normalcy has returned, while rights activists decried arbitrary arrests of activists, silencing of journalists, and draconian colonial-era laws for critical social media posts. 2 years on, arbitrary detentions continue, public assembly is still banned, and thousands of youth remain in jails, including minors. Social media vigilantism has led to dismissal of dozens of government employees, while critical reportage by journalists has got them summons and arrests under repressive laws. While Kashmiri Muslims have borne the brunt of Indian government's post-August 2019 Kashmir policy, they have also been turned into scapegoats for security failures. The detention of over 700 Kashmiri Muslims 2 weeks ago and killing of a Muslim youth in South Kashmir this week, apparently in response to recent civilian killings, follows the same disturbing trend that has somehow been normalized now.
Now, to have more insight on the situation in Kashmir, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Khan, the head of diplomatic affairs at Jammu Kashmir Liberation Front. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Now, there has been a spate of killings of members of minority Hindu and Sikh communities in Kashmir. Now, do you think it's designed to disrupt the centuries-old tradition of communal harmony and religious syncretism in the region?
Hello. One has to, first of all, condemn this because it is an absolutely not in the interest of the Kashmiri people or the struggle for the right of self-determination in the wider context of the Kashmir issue, Kashmir dispute, Kashmir conflict. This is some kind of orchestrated, sinister move that can be attributed only to those who are in power in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, and particularly in Indian occupied Kashmir. You have something like 900,000 military and paramilitary forces who have practically over the past 2 years laid siege to at least 90% of the population of the Indian occupied Kashmir of state of Jammu and Kashmir. And let's not forget, Kashmir since the 5th of August 2019 has been bifurcated and is directly ruled from New Delhi. There is no local rule in the state of Jammu and Kashmir for almost 26 months now, just over 26 months.
Now, Mr. Khan, in a major crackdown, hundreds of Kashmiri Muslims have been detained in connection with the recent killings. Now, do you agree that the security agencies are looking for a scapegoat?
Of course, there is no legal or moral justification to the Indian government, this government or previous governments, to actually deny the existence and the bona fides of the struggle to right to self-determination in Jammu and Kashmir, because there are around 24 UN resolutions and UN charter demands that the right of the people of Kashmir is sacrosanct, and that the Kashmiri people have yet to decide on the future status of their homeland, and therefore the Indian state in particular, and in the wider context, those who are occupying the state of Jammu and Kashmir are always looking for excuses and scapegoats. And indeed, the communal dimension of this killing does not serve the interest of the people of state of Jammu and Kashmir, and therefore it has to actually be the answers need to be looked at the occupying forces, the occupying authority, the state that has the power and overwhelming power, unprecedented military occupation in the state of Jammu and Kashmir under Indian occupation is something that cannot be ignored at all.
Mr. Khan, the BJP government in New Delhi claims that the abrogation of Article 370 will bring peace and development to Kashmir. So how do you assess the situation in the region 2 years down the line?
Well, in 1949, Article 370 was included or created within the Indian Constitution by the Indian state with agreement with the government of Jammu and Kashmir at that time. And the agreement was that India was only responsible for three areas, defense, foreign affairs, and communications. And India has since then actually ingressed into Kashmir and slowly occupied Kashmir and assimilated Kashmir. And abrogation of Article 370 means that since 5th of August 2019, Jammu Kashmir is an independent country occupied or reoccupied by a foreign power. And in clear contradiction of around 24 UN resolutions, and also in agreements both between the Kashmiris and Indian state, which was engaged in temporary relationship, and between India and Pakistan. So therefore, India stands a state which is accused of breaking all the rules and all the agreements that it had willingly entered into at the international level and also in the region, and also bilaterally between the Kashmiris and the Indian state over the past 74-75 years. And therefore, there is no justification whatsoever of the Indian state that it is a matter that it is internal to Indian state. It is not. It is an international issue. And so the excuses from time to time that come from New Delhi is just to reinforce its false and fallacious and also malicious policies against the Kashmiri people.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Khan for his precious time, knowledge, and insight. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
India's Congress Party politician Salman Nizami denounces mass arrests in Indian-controlled Kashmir over 7 civilian killings, noting that everyone is not a militant. Muhammad Junaid, political anthropologist, says nobody was arrested when Hindutva mobs lynched people in mainland India, while in Kashmir, hundreds were arrested for murder.